Would you join me in prayer? Our Father in heaven, we thank you for your love and your grace. And Father, this week as our country remembers our veterans and thanks on those who have devoted their lives in protecting this country and making sacrifices for this country, Father, I ask you to protect and preserve and bless each one who has sacrificed that we might have the freedom to gather this morning. Not only those who have served in the past, but also those who serve this very moment around the world, those who would love to be able to be with family and friends gathered in their homes, in their communities to worship and praise your name, but Father, are unable to do so because they're on foreign battlefields. Father, I ask you just to watch over them and bless them. And Father, help the people of the world to have wisdom that wars may come to an end and may be replaced with peace. Father, thank you for your grace. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. There are those in this room who are veterans. There are those here this morning who know what it means to be on the battlefield, who knows what it means to face the enemy, who knows what it means to face struggle, to have your life in danger, to wonder if you'll make it through the next moment, to wonder if you'll get back home to see your families. Today we talk about a man as we continue to look at the situational psalms, the psalms that fit into situations in the life of David. We look at a man who knew what it meant to go to battle, a man who knew what it meant to go to war. Today we realize that he's not only a man who knew what it meant to go to battle with enemies of foreign lands or invading armies of nearby cities and towns, but today I want us to think about a man who found that the foe was at times in his own family. We're going to be focusing today on Psalm 54. And as we look at this psalm, we're going to be moving back and forth from 1 Samuel 23 and Psalm 54. And as we move back and forth between those two things, we're going to first of all think about the situation in David's life. We want to look at the difficulty he was facing and the deliverance that God brought about. Those are two ideas that we want to think about today. And coinciding with that, we want to then move from the situation in David's life to the psalm that he wrote about the situation. That as we look at the beginning of Psalm 54 and kind of the introductory comments there that you'll see in your Bibles there before the text actually begins, it says it's a maskil or maskil, and it's likely a word that means teaching, a teaching psalm. But it specifically puts this psalm in a situation in David's life. And as we think about that psalm, I want us to look at his description of the problem, the difficulty that he's in, and then the praise that he brings forth because of God's deliverance. I hope as we go through these psalms that it brings the psalms to life. And as we go through these, my guess is you've noticed there are some similar themes, some similar things that are happening, that in each of these psalms, as we've talked about over and over, there is a complaint about some problem he's in. There is a putting of trust and confidence in God and a celebrating of God's deliverance. But I not only want us to see that constant theme, but I want us to see that David consistently ties it to situation after situation in his life. In other words, he doesn't just say it once when he's facing this problem and then you don't hear it from him again. Over and over, no matter what he's facing, he continues to have the same attitude. So let's talk today for a few moments about the situation in David's life. Let's talk about what's going on. To do that, we're going to need to go back to 1 Samuel chapters 22 and 23. And I apologize, I think one of the Samuels, I've got a U and an E backwards. But as we look at the story of David in 1 and 2 Samuel, let's kind of back up and bring ourselves back up to this particular event. If we go to 1 Samuel chapter 22, David has been to the city of Nob. This is where the high priest is. This is where a tent has been set up, and this is where many of the items that would have been in the tabernacle are in this particular tent at the city of Nob. Remember there, he went to see Ahimelech, the high priest. He went there for advice from God. He went there to get something to eat, and he went there to get a weapon. And so he left with something to eat, he left with guidance from God, and he left with the sword of Goliath. But remember that Doeg, a man who was treacherous and deceitful, turned over David and Ahimelech and the priest of Nob to Saul. In other words, later Saul is feeling sorry for himself. He's kind of pouting because it seems like everybody's against him and everybody's on David's side. And so Doeg, who's been kind of storing away this information, sees his opportunity and he says, "You know, it just so happens I've seen David and I can tell you where I saw him." So they call in Ahimelech, and remember, Ahimelech doesn't know that David's on the run. He doesn't know what's going on. David didn't tell him what was going on, that David was actually fleeing for his life from Saul. Ahimelech doesn't know that, and so he innocently, you know, tells the truth to King Saul, that he doesn't know, you know, why you would have a problem with David. He didn't know David was on the run. He assumed he's your most faithful servant, etc. But that doesn't satisfy Saul. And so Saul ends up taking his life, in fact, kills 85 priests and wipes out basically the entire village. And so we see the tremendous hatred that he has for David, and that in Saul you see a man who began so well but is now totally out of control. He has lost contact with and his relationship with God. Something important happens at the end of that chapter. One son of the high priest lives, Abiathar. And we're going to find that, if we look in chapter 23, that Abiathar, first of all, the end of chapter 22 tells us that Abiathar goes to David. And what you continue to see happen, we referred to this last week, the people who are oppressed, the people who are downtrodden, the people who are hurting and frustrated and on the run, are little by little coming over to David. Remember last week when we talk about the cave of Adullam, that when David comes to that cave, it says his family gathered to him, his immediate family, and then others who were oppressed began to gather to him, and he had 400 men. Well, you're going to find in 1 Samuel chapter 23 that it refers to a battle that takes place, and by the time this battle is over, he's now got 600 men. You're going to find that Gad the prophet has come to him. You're going to find that now the remaining high priest, Abiathar, who is the descendant of Ahimelech, who was killed by Saul, he comes to David. And actually what's happening is you're getting all the components of what it means to be a king. If you're a king, you're a military leader, and so an army has gathered to him. If you're a king, you're a spokesman for God, and so the prophets speak to you from God, and so it is that he has a prophet in Gad. And if you're a king, then you're supposed to be in a relationship with God, and you're supposed to emphasize the people's relationship with God. And so therefore you're going to stress the priesthood and the Levites. And so now the high priest is with him. He basically has everything but the throne in the capital city. He has all the earmarks and makings of what it means to be king. He's already been anointed as king in 1 Samuel 16. And really what you have playing out in Samuel, at least this portion, is you have two anointed men. You have two men who have been anointed as king. And you have a comparison and contrast of their stories as they are going in two totally different directions. One man is moving away from God and is leading for himself. The other man is going towards God and is leading for the benefit of God's kingdom and the benefit of God's people. And so the numbers coming to him are growing, but it's significant that Abiathar comes. Because remember, the reason that David went to Nob in the first place was to inquire of the Lord. He went to the high priest. On the high priest's breastplate, you had something called, or things called, the Urim and Thummim. We don't actually know exactly how they worked, but they were used in the Old Testament to get guidance from God. And so that was a way that they could ask God a question, and using those devices could determine God's answer. And so what David had done in the first place, before all these priests were killed, the reason he went there was to inquire of God. And so it's interesting that when Abiathar, the lone remaining son of the former high priest, who now is high priest himself, escapes to David, it just so happens that he brings with him the ephod and the breastplate and the very Urim and Thummim, the very things that were needed to inquire of the Lord. So David has God's high priest and has God's appointed means of asking him questions. Those things are now traveling with him everywhere he goes. And that's going to be significant with what plays out in chapter 23. So you continue to have these oppressed peoples and these people who are outcast who are coming to David. In 1 Samuel chapter 23, you can see up there on the screen, in verses 1 through 15, David is traveling, and all of this is taking place. We'll pull up a map in a few moments. All of this is taking place basically south of Jerusalem and Bethlehem. And it's going to be taking place not too terribly far from the town of Hebron, either northwest of Hebron or down south of Hebron. But there is a village that's roughly 7 miles northwest of the city of Hebron. It would have been southwest of the city of Bethlehem and the city of Jerusalem. And that particular city is called Keilah. And Keilah was a city that was over near the border where the Philistines were. And David has heard that the Philistines are invading this village or this city. It was a significant enough size city that it actually had its own wall and barred gates. So he hears that the Philistines are invading this border town, if you will. Now here, I want you to think about what David's going through. David's on the run from Saul himself. He's on the run from his own king. But he finds out that a foreign king is invading their land. And so again, seeing the attitude of David, which is so foreign to Saul, Saul is so busy trying to find David, he's not protecting his own towns. David, on the other hand, is busy protecting the towns of their country. In other words, you see one that is the king but's not acting like one. One has not yet become king but is acting like the king. And so what he does is he goes to God and he says, "Father, do we need to attack this village? The Philistines are attacking. What do you want me to do?" And basically God tells him to attack the village. He goes to his soldiers of about 600 and said, let's go attack the Philistines. They're going to take the village of Keilah. And his soldiers say, "Now wait a minute, we're scared to death of our own king and you want us to go fight a foreign king?" And David says, "Okay," and he goes back to God and just confirms God's message. "Father, what do you want us to do? Do you want us to attack?" And the father says, "Yes." So David goes back to his men and they invade and they win a great victory. Now Saul hears that he's at the city of Keilah. It's a city with walls. And so if David's inside the city, then Saul says, "Hey, we can surround him. We can capture him in the city. We've got him corralled, if you will." And so what happens is David hears that Saul is on the way to attack him. Even though he's just delivered one of Saul's cities from their enemies, Saul is still out to get him as he's at this walled city of Keilah. And so again, David inquires of the Lord. This is the third time that he inquires of the Lord in 1 Samuel chapter 23. And I want you to notice a consistent pattern in that in his life of inquiring of the Lord before he makes big decisions. And so what he does is he goes to the Lord and he basically says, "Saul is coming to destroy this city." Now why might that be heavily on the mind of David? I want you to go back to what's just happened at the end of 1 Samuel chapter 22. What has Saul just done? Saul has just wiped out a village of priests along with their wives and children. If he will kill the high priest and the folks who devote themselves to service to God, who will he not kill? And so David says in 1 Samuel 23, he is afraid that Saul is coming to now kill the people of the city of Keilah because David is there. And so David then inquires of the Lord and says to the Lord, "Will these people give me up?" In other words, I've just saved all of these people in this city, but when Saul gets here and surrounds the city, will they stand beside me in essence, or will they turn me over to Saul? And he says, "They'll turn you over to Saul." Isn't that sad? Even when David along the way tries to help people, those people ultimately out of fear end up turning against him. And so as he leaves Keilah, he is going to travel onward from there and he's going to end up in the wilderness of Ziph, Z-I-P-H. And this is a region that's kind of down south of Hebron. And while he's in Ziph, he's going to find that Saul hears that he's there. And here's what happens. He's in the region of Ziph, and the people of this region are going to go back to Saul, and they're going to tell Saul that David is in their region. They're going to say, "Is not David among us? Come down at your leisure and capture him." And I think we may have a few scriptures that you pull up on the screen that show them talking about that from 1 Samuel chapter 23, if the guys will pull that up. But as we look at 1 Samuel chapter 23, the people of Ziph are going to come to Saul and tell him where David is. then what Saul is going to do is say, you find out exactly where he is and you come back and tell me. And so that is exactly what the people do. And I'd like to look with you at what is going on. Look, if you will, in verse 24. David is actually at the city of Maon in the region of Ziph. The people of this particular region, the Ziphites, have now located David and have turned the information over to Saul. Then they arose and went to Ziph before Saul. Now David and his men were in the wilderness of Maon, in the Arabah to the south of Jeshimon. When Saul and his men went to seek him, they told David, and he came down to the rock and stayed in the wilderness of Maon. And when Saul heard it, he pursued David in the wilderness of Maon. So he went on one side of the mountain, and David and his men on the other side of the mountain. And David was hurrying to get away from Saul, for Saul and his men were surrounding David and his men to seize them. So I want you to see what's happened. Everywhere David has gone, he's found trouble. He went to even live among the Philistines, and they sought his life. Everywhere he's gone, people have turned against him. When people have befriended him, Saul has killed them. He then rescues the people of the village of Keilah, and he finds out they're going to turn him over. So he goes to the region of the Ziphites, and they turn him over to Saul. Everybody's scared to death of Saul. And Saul is a rampaging madman who's out to get David. And it is in this circumstance, it is against this background, in this situation, that we have the first words of Psalm 54. So let's read our passage. Let's picture a David who is fleeing with his 600 men, and he is just literally a mountain away from death. Saul's army's on one side of the mountain. He's on the other side of the mountain. And whatever time in the future he writes this psalm, he's thinking about that moment. He says, "Save me, O God, by your name, and vindicate me by your power. Hear my prayer, O God. Give ear to the words of my mouth. For strangers have risen against me, and violent men have sought my life. They have not set God before them." Selah. And remember that phrase, Selah, is a musical notation that just means pause. And so what he's basically saying when he puts that in a psalm is pause and think about what I've just sung or just written. Now, I want you to think about a couple of key things here. First of all, I want you to notice the reference to by your name. He's going to put that in this section, and then he's going to put that in the next section. In this section, he's going to basically say, I put trust in your name. And then the next section, he's going to say, because of what you've done for me, I'm going to praise your name. We need to remember that in the Old Testament, in the ancient world, a name was more than just a handle you stuck on somebody so you could differentiate them from somebody else. So that's Joe, and that's Fred, that's Susie, and that's Sally, so we can tell each other apart. But names really represented the person. They didn't generally name the person when the child was immediately born. It was several days. In fact, often it was at least 8 days later when they would circumcise the male children that they would actually name the child. They waited a little while. Part of the reason for that seems to have been so they had a little time to watch the baby and see a little bit about the baby's personality. Because they often attached the name to the personality of the person or to events that surrounded their coming into the world, whether it was a Jacob as a supplanter who was trying to steal the leadership from his brother by reaching out to grab him. Whatever it is, you see those kind of events all through the Old Testament. And when a significant change took place in a person's life, there was usually a significant change in the name. For example, you've got Abram, which means exalted father. Well, God then makes a covenant with him and says he's going to make a great nation, in fact, multiple nations from him. And so he changes his name from Abram, which means exalted father, to Abraham, which means father of nations. You can even get to the New Testament. You've got Simon, who Jesus begins to call Peter, which means the rock. There's a change in what he's going to become. There's a change because of Christ being in his life. And so names are very significant. They represent the person. They represent their character. They represent who they are or what they're all about. So if you were to say, I like your name, that means you like the person. If you say, I believe in the name, you say, I believe in the person, your character, and who you are and what you're all about. And so what he's basically saying is, save me, O God, by your name, by your presence, by your character, by your power. I believe in you. And then he describes what's happening to him. And I couldn't help but think about a story I read this week about a man down in Alabama, and I don't think they still know all the details of why he was on the railroad tracks, but there was a man down in Alabama who was lying on the railroad tracks, and the train went over top of him. I mean, the conductor laid on the horn and laid on, did everything he could to try to wake the man up or get him to get out of the way, but he never would. And before he could stop the train, 8 cars had gone over this man. Amazingly, the man lived through it, and they think he's going to be okay. But as I think of David and all he's been through, I mean, you talk about being run over by a train, car after car after car. People in the capital city, the king, foreign nations, over and over, David has been run over, he's been run out, he's been beaten up, and this is a man whom God said is going to be king. And here's what really is hard about this portion of the story. Because we need to remember that David is from the tribe of Judah. The village that he delivered from the Philistines, Keilah, it's from the tribe of Judah. You remember the region that he ran to hide, the wilderness of Ziph? And you remember the city of Maon? They're all in the tribe of Judah. In other words, he didn't run to the tribe of Benjamin. That's Saul's people. He didn't go hide in some other tribe. He went to his own people. He went to hide in his own tribe. All these are people that are distantly related to him. They're all connected. They're family. They're the kind of folks that might show up at a family reunion every once in a while. They're the ones that turned him over. I just want you to feel his utter despair. And I want you to notice, though, how he describes them in verse 3. He says they're strangers. Have you ever felt like a stranger in your own home? Have you ever felt like a stranger among your own family? My guess is everybody in this room at some point has been hurt by somebody in their family. And my guess is that most of us have probably hurt somebody in our family along the way. Even though we may be connected by blood, there may be times in life when they seem like strangers to us. When they do things to hurt us and break our hearts. That's where David is. It wasn't just anybody that turned him over. It's not that it was just even a city that he had just rescued. It was family he had just rescued from the Philistines that was willing to turn him over. Because they were seriously scared. And fear drives people to do things. As we look at the life of Jesus, Jesus knew what it meant to struggle with betrayal by family. In John chapter 7 and verse 5, we find Jesus is going up to Jerusalem. They're seeking Jesus' life. And as they're getting ready to go up to the feast, Jesus is going to delay. But his brothers come to him and say, "Hey, if you're who you say you are, then you ought to go up and show everybody." I know, and the kind of underlying thing behind this is, I know they're trying to kill you, but brother, if you're really what you're all cracked up to be, that shouldn't bother you. And the text says that even his own brothers didn't believe in him. I want you to think what it was like for Jesus to go out into the world and preach the gospel and to know that if he went back to his own home and sat down to dinner with his own brothers, they don't believe the message he's preaching. The brothers he grew up with, the brothers he played with, the brothers he'd probably helped and shared deep and intimate secrets with along the road of life, didn't believe in him. In fact, Jesus would say in Mark chapter 6, I think in verse 4, He says, "A prophet is not without honor except in his own hometown and in his own household." In fact, we look over in Mark chapter 3, verse 21, verses 33 through 35, his family basically came to get him because they thought he had gone mad. And so he is gathered with his followers when his family arrives. And they say, "Your mom and your brothers and sisters, they're all outside." And Jesus says, who is my family? Who is my mother? Who are my brothers? He says, it's those who accept the will of my Father. In Mark chapter 13, Jesus was talking to these same apostles in verses 12 through 14. He says, there is a day coming when parents will betray their children and children will betray their parents and will turn them over to the enemy. And he says, in essence, the whole world is going to turn against you because of me. In John chapter 15, he told those same apostles, he says, the world will hate you because the world hates me. In other words, Jesus knew what it meant to be betrayed by family. And he said to his apostles, it's going to happen to you. If you live and seek to do what's right, even people of your own household may turn against you. That is exactly where David is. But that is not where the song ends. Because we look in verse 6, it says, willingly I will sacrifice, or excuse me, let's start in verse 4 of Psalm 54. He said, behold, God is my helper. The Lord is the sustainer of my soul. He will recompense the evil to my foes. Destroy them in your faithfulness. Willingly I will sacrifice to you. I will give thanks to your name, O Lord, for it is good. For he has delivered me from all trouble, and my eye has looked with satisfaction upon my enemies. If we go back to our story in 1 Samuel chapter 23, if you look at what happens in verse 27, remember in verse 26, he's on one side of the mountain and Saul's army is on the other side. In verse 27, it says of 1 Samuel 23, but a messenger came to Saul saying, hurry and come, for the Philistines have made a raid on the land. So Saul returned from pursuing David, and he went to meet the Philistines. Therefore they called the place the Rock of Escape. God brought deliverance. And so David is either writing after that fact here in Psalm 54, or he is writing in anticipation of that fact. And it seems that sometimes in his Psalms, he writes about those events maybe before they take place. He's so confident that God will answer his prayers that he envisions the day when those prayers become a reality. As we look at what he says here in Psalm 54, I'm reminded of James chapter 5, verse 13. It says, if you're suffering, pray. If you're rejoicing, sing. I want you to think about what David did all through 1 and 2nd, or especially 1 Samuel, excuse me. I want you to notice what he does. Every time he faces trouble, he goes to God. Three times in chapter 23, when he's in the middle of suffering, he talks to God about it. On the other hand, what's Saul doing the whole time? He's talking to spies and traitors and turncoats. All his information comes from deceitful, deceptive, and scared people. David's information comes from the God of the universe. That's exactly what James said do. When you're facing struggle, go to God. And when God answered those prayers, then David did also what James 5:13 said to do. He lifted up songs of praise to God. He says in verse 6, I will give thanks to your name, O Lord, for it is good. Remember at the beginning of the song, he says, save me, O God, by your name. And God saved him. God delivered him. And so he says, I praise your name. I praise who you are. I praise your power. And I praise your character. As we think about David in the wilderness, I want us to think about three things as we think about the foe. And we think about when family is the foe. I want us to remember that family isn't perfect. That family's going to let us down at some point along the road of life. That just as David felt betrayed, there will be times when all of us will feel that way. We need to remember that when people are scared, sometimes they do things they wouldn't normally do. We need to remember when we're thinking about those people of Keilah, they heard what happened to the priest over there at Nob. They knew how ruthless Saul had been. They knew they didn't want their children butchered in the streets. So yes, they betrayed David, and it was wrong. But sometimes people do things they shouldn't when they get scared. And we need to remember that sometimes we let family down. In fact, later on in his life, David would do that very thing in his own family. We need to also realize that while family may let us down, there are others who will come to our aid. Something I didn't mention that's found at the beginning of 1 Samuel 23 is that before David, or while David was traveling and in the wilderness of Ziph at a place called Horesh, Jonathan, Saul's son, came to meet him. He's just been betrayed by family, but then the son of the man who's trying to kill him comes to meet him, and this is the last time that these two best friends would meet in this life. The next time David sees Jonathan, he's dead. And Jonathan says, "Don't pay any attention to my father, for God will not let him have you. He says, you will be king, and I will be your second." Jesus, even as his family stood outside the door wanting to take him home because they thought he was a wild and madman, was able to look around the room and find friends who did believe in him, even if his brothers did not. Don't focus on the people who are hurting us, even if it's family. Don't focus on the people who are called family. Focus on the people who are acting like family. The people who are helping us. Because if we'll look around, we'll find there are some Jonathans who want to be there for us. And the third thing is envision God's victory. Always put our trust in God. And envision a day when God is going to make it right. See what is in the future as if it is here today, and it will transform today and give us the hope to face tomorrow. Would you take out your psalm books and turn to the hymn of encouragement? As you turn there, I'm reminded of William Tyndale, the man who is credited with giving us the printed Bible in English translated from the Hebrew and Greek. It had not been done before. And it was so upsetting to the power, the political elite, the elite in religious circles, that eventually William Tyndale was captured and imprisoned and put to death for the audacity of putting the Bible in the language of the common people so they could read it for themselves. You and I are able to read the Bible in English today in part because of men like William Tyndale. Do you know why William Tyndale ended up being executed? He was betrayed by a friend. There will be people in this world who hurt us and let us down. But there will also be times when we hurt others and let them down. The key to surviving all of this is forgiveness. Extending forgiveness to those who have hurt us, seeking forgiveness from those whom we have hurt, and ultimately putting our trust in God, having faith in Him and seeking His forgiveness. The same God who hung on the cross of Calvary looked down at those who put the spikes in His hands and said, "Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing." If you're not a child of God, I want you to realize in God you have family who will never let you down. He will never disappoint you. If you believe that His Son is the one who came to this earth and died for your sins and was resurrected on the third day, and you're willing to express that faith in baptism, I pray you'll do that this morning. For those of us who are Christians, if there's some problem between us and somebody else, whether it's family or not, let's fix it. Let's make it right with them, whether it's our fault or their fault, because eventually all of us are going to be at fault. Let's make it right. And let's go to our God and seek His forgiveness as we stand and sing.